Welcome back to The Filibuster, the podcast of Union's Political Science Department. When we last were speaking, we had talked about the challenges that Trump is facing. So I guess we're calling the Senate back into recess. And since you had the floor, we're going to continue by letting you speak. Except this time, we'll switch and talk a little bit more about who he is who he is appointing to key jobs in the foreign policy apparatus. Now, when I look at Trump's appointments overall, I have to say he's kind of appointing a motley crew that reflects his unorthodox, eccentric, and somewhat jumbled political beliefs. He has doves and hawks, libertarians, activists, traditionalists, and revolutionary authoritarians and anti-establishment. To a certain extent, we see this incoherence, or you could say in a more positive way, a flexible, adaptable, open type approach with mainstream appointees like Marco Rubio, who is Secretary of State designate, Mike Waltz, the incoming National Security Advisor, and John Ratcliffe at CIA. And then we have those, to borrow from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, who cry havoc and want to let loose the dogs of war against the bureaucracy and the deep state. So let's start with looking at some of his mainstream appointments first. All right.
Can I say one thing before we jump in?
No. I'm
you have the floor.
No.
I
yield to my distinguished colleague.
Well, I'd like to add just one thing, that I do think there is one through line that connects all these people. You know, as you said, it's not ideology, it's not plans, it's not background, but I do think they're all people that Trump thinks will be loyal to him.
Yeah.
And I think that's the one element here that's different.
The one thing through everything is he thinks these people will do what he wants.
That's right.
They'll be on his side. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Correct on that. All right. Let's start. What does the appointment of Marco Rubio as Secretary of State mean?
You know, the appointment of Rubio is interesting because it probably gave a lot of people relief.
Yeah, exactly.
Rubio has a reputation as being somebody who has experience on foreign policy. He's someone who is fairly mainstream in his way of thinking about it. But he's also someone who's evolved in the last few years on his foreign policy
positions. Right, I mean, he started off as a neocon in foreign policy.
He might object to the characterization, but that's the box he often gets put in. What he is now, and I think the predominant thing about his approach now, is that he is a China hawk. You know, if we want to talk about the three big focuses, you can focus on Iran, Russia, or China. When that is on the table, Rubio is solidly in the let's focus on China camp. And those are the people who want to end the Ukraine war quickly. Those are the people who want to limit the amount of things that we send to the Middle East, because all of that attention needs to be on China from that perspective. And I think that's the camp that Rubio is now in.
Okay. He's also been very bipartisan of the Senate Intelligence Committee.
He's fairly well respected. He's not going to have any challenges getting through the Senate. He's popular there, you know.
Yeah, right. So it's less about what goes on in the Senate. It's more about how well he works with others, as far as
goes. And there's one person in particular we need to know how well he works with, and that's Donald Trump,
With Trump, yes. Yeah. All right. So next is his National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, a congressman from Florida.
Yeah, and he, if we put Marco Rubio in the category of China hawk, there's not a lot of people that beat him, but this is one of them. So, you know, I think, and this is a theme we're going to see as it develops, I think across the board, there are some very interesting exceptions, but the people that are being put in these positions are people who want to focus on China, and Waltz is in the same position. Now, he's somebody who, unlike Rubio, he does have a history of Ukraine skepticism. He's expressed wanting to limit funding, things like that. You know, not a Russia. We'll say someone who's open to Russian appeals, like some other people. But he is someone who thinks
who
that
might
the
that well, be? We'll, no, we'll yeah, get there, yeah, we'll
but
get
the,
there. Yes,
the his approach, though, is very much Ukraine is a distraction from China.
Okay, so help people understand this. We've been talking about the pivot to Asia for I don't know
how
long.
Yeah.
And so even the Biden administration has talked about the pivot to Asia. So can you pivot to Asia and also be concerned about the Middle East and Ukraine and be active there? Or do you have to prioritize in such a way as to where China's your main focus and everything else is kind of if we have time?
The sad truth of it is that you cannot do all those things on our current military budget. We just do not, you know, I think we are, in terms of public opinion and popular ideas of U.S. military spending, we are still in the 2010s where we have this idea that the U.S. military spending just dwarfs all the other countries in the world. And there's no, that's not true anymore. And the sooner that people understand that, I think the sooner we'll have more realistic understandings of why we have to make priority decisions like this. But, you know, there were those some from the Department of Defense, from the American Enterprise Institute, trying to make a more accurate assessment of China's actual defense expenditures, where they had them at almost parity with the United States.
Well, and the other thing about China is the old Mike Tyson thing, you always have a plan until the first punch.
Well, and
right? And that's kind of thing. China has spent all this money, but the Chinese military's never been tested. I mean, not in... I mean, they've got some border skirmishes with India, but large-scale fighting?
That's true. The scary thing about this is that that's kind of true of our Navy as well.
Well, and the other thing about our Navy is they're dealing with a lot of old ships, and they're mothballing them as they get older, and we're not replacing them.
Well, and the kind... So, again, we're going to talk about the nightmare scenario a little bit here, right? So understand that this is what all good foreign policy is trying to avoid. But if you're in a circumstance where you're actually in a direct conventional conflict with China, the maritime battles are not like they're not like land battles. They're large, decisive, and terrible. When you lose everything or a lot. A ship with 3,000 people on it sinks, you're looking at a lot of casualties.
Right.
And we can't replace those ships. That's the other thing. I mean, Chinese shipbuilding capability vastly outpaces ours. Chinese industrial production vastly outpaces ours. If we're in a conflict that goes on for more than a month or two, we're in trouble. And we're also in an era of missile conflict, right? So it's not, you know, we might have these sort of romantic images of our heads of what a naval battle looks like from our memories of World War II, but we're not looking at that kind of conflict anymore. We're looking at conflict where one or two missiles can sink an entire ship, and under those circumstances, it's really not that important who has the better ships, it's who has more.
Well,
And
part of it also, we have the hypersonic missiles.
That's right.
More difficult to...
Very difficult to intercept.
Because of the speed,
And China's going to be launching them from the land, where we're going to be launching them at sea. It's not a big mystery where a missile came from if you know where the enemy fleet is, right?
Sure,
and
right.
I'm not trying to make people alarmed at these things, because again, the purpose of good foreign policy is to avoid this outcome. But in the event of that outcome, I'm not sure we even fight it, right? Just put yourself in Donald Trump's shoes for a second. Imagine the challenge comes and, you know, China's doing something like invading Taiwan or maybe the Philippines, right? I mean, like something crazy is happening. And you have to decide, okay, is now the time when we go toe-to-toe with the Chinese military and the, you know, PLA Navy? And if you have to make that decision and you guess wrong, well, even if you guess right, even if we win, we are going to look at sunk ships.
Yeah.
Right? And, I mean, there are going to be thousands of American casualties, and we're going to lose ships that we can't replace. How do you go to the American people and explain that? I mean, do you think that the president who makes that mistake survives the next election? Right?
Well, that's not something Trump has to worry about.
Well, his party or whatever, right? I mean, just imagine the backlash, right?
Yes.
I'm not sure any president can credibly threaten to take that gamble, and that's the problem.
Well, I think from what I've heard, the naval commander who's in charge of that region, the idea is to throw up a whole bunch of stuff to make it difficult for China to actually land on Taiwan.
If we choose to defend there, yes.
And raise the cost in a way to where we're using drones and other kinds of things to where our ships aren't actually engaging with China.
And
to give Taiwan the capability of creating enough trouble to where China cannot successfully invade.
Those are all very important things for us to say so that we can signal a willingness to defend Taiwan. But I think the real truth is that once that conflict starts, Taiwan doesn't matter anymore. Because someone's going to win the war, and then that'll decide what happens to Taiwan. And when you're in that scenario, the question is take the war or don't take the war, not defend Taiwan or don't defend Taiwan. And if the answer is take the war, then we're dealing with the costs. And if the answer is don't take the war, then Taiwan's gone, right? Like that's the real dilemma. And that's just a big challenge. So how do you avoid that? Well, that's one area where I think the China hawks do have a point. And this is that you have to demonstrate to China, you have to make China believe that we would take the war. And how do you make them believe that? Well, first of all, you have to have a lot of stuff there. You have to be willing to spend a lot of money there. You have to show that the we're already paying for half a war. We might as well finish it, right? That's the sort of thing you have to convince them. And then you have to convince your allies in Asia that you would take the war. So how do you do that? Well, you have to get more involved in their politics. You have to expand your bases there, right? You have to maybe even get more bases if you can. You have to build ships. That's the other side.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and that takes a while.
It takes a while, but at least you have to show you're getting started. I mean, these are the things that if we wanted to prevent that outcome, we would have to demonstrate. So, you know, I think that, you know, as much as, you know, these people are... China hawk is a term I don't necessarily like. It's the term, so I'll keep using it. But what they're really saying is we need to throw enough stuff into the Pacific Ocean that China believes us. And that's an expensive thing to do. It's an expensive thing to do if you also want to maintain Europe and the Middle East, which we do, right? You know, Waltz isn't saying he wants Ukraine to be defeated. He's saying he wants that conflict to be done. Because it would also be, you know, what makes it really hard to focus on China if you're actively losing in Europe, right?
Yeah.
You know, or if even worse, the war expands in Europe, because that's the other thing. If the outcome of the Ukraine war is really bad for Ukraine, you are looking at a situation where Europe has to arm, right? And of course, they're already trying to arm, but an arms race between Europe and Russia is an extremely volatile scenario. You know, the European continent has been a place of near constant warfare throughout history up until the end of World War II.
Right.
And what was it at the end of World War II that kept it peaceful? It wasn't...
The U.S.
It was the United States.
Yes.
Right. And so a world where the U.S. is very heavily involved in Europe is a war where... is the only world historically where we've seen a peaceful Europe.
Okay. So what... Is there a Europe whisperer in Trump's foreign policy appointees?
No.
Okay. Well, okay. Then let's go talk about some of the others, and I'm sure we'll circle back to some of these things. All right. John Radcliffe, who's being proposed as director of the CIA.
I think that it's the same story with him, and I'm sure we're going to talk about his pick for defense as well in a minute. These are people who seem to be way more focused on U.S. domestic politics. I think, and this is going to get maybe into the next part of this conversation, but... these are not people who are... This is not a declaration of war against Russia, Iran, or China. This is a declaration of war against the bureaucracy in some ways. And I think that we have some of these appointees are very internally focused. And I'm not here to say that's a bad thing necessarily, and maybe you can tell me more about how that works in a second. But because, you know, I understand the desire to have control of your own agencies, but I don't think that Ratcliffe is... I don't think there's a lot that you can read there and say, oh, okay, these are the things that he's going to prioritize when, you know, he's going to try and clean house.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, so that's part of the idea about what's he going to actually do there.
Yeah.
The idea is how much will he clean house, because that gets to the idea of, okay, well, let's just hop into the whole deep state idea.
Okay, yeah.
Because this is kind of why they're talking about cleaning house at defense, CIA, justice, and the FBI. So help us out here. What is the deep state?
Well, you know, if you looked at Trump's last administration and you tried to and he failed to do a lot of what he wanted to do. And one explanation that some people have landed on is that he never had the support of his bureaucracy, that at every turn he was opposed by the people who worked for him. So the term that they started using for this is the deep state. It's this idea that the agencies themselves have an agenda, and that agenda can be contrary to that of the president. So before we begin and talk about what Trump wants to do about that, why don't you tell us, Sean, is that real? I mean, is that why Trump's policies failed?
Okay. So, I mean, this is where, when I look at that, what you described is not typically what they claim about a deep state. Mm-hmm. So when they're talking about a deep state, we're looking at the idea that there's a cadre of career government employees working together to secretly manipulate policy, yeah, undermine elected leaders, and take down Trump. Mm-hmm. And so you see this in what people refer to as lawfare, to where the Democrats tried to disqualify Trump through prosecutions, whether at the state level in New York, federal elections, federal, in terms of January 6th, or the classified documents, and of course, states trying to keep him off the ballot. That's one part. But part of the other idea was he claimed that defense and intelligence officials were not doing what he wanted and were working to undermine him. Part of this deals with the idea of the leak from Vindman and in the CIA about his call to Zelensky, which led to his first impeachment. I think that's different than what we typically think about bureaucratic behavior. And what we have always seen is that presidents have always complained about the bureaucracy for a couple of reasons. Well, first is they think that they're head of the bureaucracy. Yes and no. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, in theory, they are the head. But in reality, they're not, because what we have to remember is that a lot of the agencies were created to satisfy clientele interest. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not the case in the big four of state, defense, treasury, and state defense, treasury, justice. Mm-hmm. Those are the kinds of departments that everyone will have. But what's also related to this is the idea that every agency believes in its mission.
Right.
The people who work there believe in its mission. They applied for jobs there because they believe in it. They're promoted based on that mission. And so if you try to challenge that mission, then there's going to be pushback.
Sure.
Now, the pushback is typically referred to as what we call drift or slack. Drift is the idea that an agency sometimes shifts its mission from what it was originally intended. That's probably less the case in the intel agencies, because their mission is know what everyone else is doing and help us figure out so that we can make good decisions. The part that may be more appropriate is slack, which is the idea is if you're doing something that they don't like, then they're not going to move as quickly to do that. Or they may leak information about the people trying to do this to get them fired, or to make it difficult to where they have to, that their power is weakened,
sure,
and eventually they might resign, which means most appointees last about a year and a half to 2 years. The bureaucrats last much longer.
Right.
And that's why Trump has talked a lot about Schedule F. Elf, you see, it's Christmas time. I'm thinking a lot like that. Schedule F deals with the idea of being able to fire bureaucrats who deal with policy. Mm-hmm. Now, it's those who make policy decisions. The actual last thing they've talked about is people who can view policy documents, which is a much wider group of people. But the question is, if you fire these people, you have to replace them with people, and do they have the expertise, the skills, and everything else? And that's questionable. The best way to deal with this, I think, with Schedule F, is to say, here's what we can do. If you want to keep your job, do what we want. But I think this idea that people, and the other thing to throw in there is, these agencies and departments are created by Congress. They're funded by Congress. And if they do what the president wants, but what Congress doesn't want, then they suffer for that in terms of authorization, funding, and other kinds of things. Sure. So the bureaucracy is kind of caught in our separated power systems, to where multiple people are claiming power over them, whether interest groups, president, Congress, and let's throw in the courts too, in the sense to where if people don't like what's going on, they're going to challenge those in court.
It's never a good situation if your manager and your HR director disagree.
Yes. Well, and the question is, who is your manager? Mm-hmm. Is it the president? Is it the Congress? Or is it the people who you might have come from to get that job and you may want a job with after you leave?
Yes.
And so there's all sorts of conflicting ideas and responsibilities and authority, to where I do believe there is a issue to where bureaucracies will not always follow a president, but I don't think it's for malicious reasons most of the times. I mean, what you will find out with most everyone who serves in a bureaucracy is after they leave, they have high praise for the civil servants that they've worked with, regardless of party.
Sure, right.
And part of this is the populist idea of that there is a elite working against the interest of the people. There's a pure people that the populist leader represents, and when they don't succeed, instead of saying, I wasn't competent, my ideas are bad, you blame it on this amorphous blob, which they call the deep state.
Sure.
Which, if you look at Kash Patel, who wrote a book about the deep state, and where he named members of the deep state, well, the members of the deep state were people Trump appointed, were people who Biden appointed, and people who were elected to office.
Right.
And so the people he lists as deep state weren't really bureaucrats. They were people appointed or elected to these positions.
Now, you mentioned Kash Patel. He's one of the ones we need to talk about, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he's a nominee, isn't he?
Right, for director of the FBI.
That's right.
BI.
So what do we think that means?
Well, that's the big question here. I mean, Kash Patel has said we need to prosecute the people. Part of this idea, less Ratcliffe, more Hegseth, Gabbard, and Patel. And I guess we could throw in Matt Gaetz, who's gone, replaced by Pam Biondi, is Trump's especially upset at the Justice Department for the investigations of him, and he wants to clean house to punish those people who went after him. Yeah. And the question is, who's he going to... How are they going to be able to do it? And if they replace them, who are they going to replace them with? And then do they go after the people who they thought went after them?
So should we be expecting a purge?
I think that's the big question. And the thing with purges, though, is I've never known a purge to work out well.
Yeah.
So think about this. You're concerned about China, and you're going to purge the Intel agency when you need the people who know best going on. I mean, I think back to Stalin's purge pre-World War II and the military, the intelligence agencies and everything else, and that backfired against him, and that's why Russia took such large losses at the beginning, to where eventually they had to recalibrate. And so I think this is the big thing, is, and if you go after your opponents, if Kash Patel or Biondi goes after them, one, you're going to get a lot of people upset. That means you're going to have political pushback, yeah, which is going to lower your capital to be able to do what you want to do. But the other thing to remember is you can harass people without prosecuting them by even just talking, sure, about that. But still, that can also backfire in some ways. I don't think Biondi wants to prosecute people. Mm-hmm. With Kash Patel, the question is, he's someone who people who have worked with him says he should be nowhere near power. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, would he abuse his office? People are saying, will he try to be a J. Edgar Hoover who tries, yeah, to collect data on people to blackmail them to get them to do what they want? Or will he threaten investigations,
sure,
to get people to do what he wants? And so there's all sorts of concerns. Are we going to break down the norms about, mm-hmm, how we handle these kinds of things? There are norms that regulate how we investigate high-profile political officials. The question is, are we going to undermine them?
Well, and this kind of gets back to what we said at the very beginning of this through line of loyalty, right? Where it does seem like, I mean, I think Trump is very aware of these trade-offs you're talking about here. If you look at the types of picks he's doing, the way he talks about his picks, I think he perceives himself to be in a trade-off situation where he is sacrificing some efficiency for alignment. Is he making a mistake?
Well, so okay, here's my view. I don't think there is a deep state. I mean, mm-hmm, I think there are real reasons why the bureaucracy is slow to react, mm-hmm, at times in their, they've got different people they have to please and the different people want different things. But to say that there's some malicious thing going
on.
Say
that it's organized, right? Yeah, right.
That's where it breaks organized down. Secret attempt,
right,
to undermine Trump, I disagree with it because, let's be honest, Trump was his own worst enemy, sure, his first term. And so the biggest thing I've always said about Trump is his superpower is self-destruction. Mm-hmm. And so the thing is, will he go with that? He's talked about success will be his greatest revenge, but he nurses a sense of grievance, especially against the Justice,
right,
Department. That's where I think we're going to see the greatest purge going on there.
Well, and like most theories like this, there's a hard version and a soft version,
yeah,
right? The hard version of the deep state theory, yeah, it's kind of hard to defend, right? But the soft version that Trump does have problems with his bureaucracy, that he doesn't get along well with them, and many of it, like you say, is self-inflicted. I mean, do we think that because of this very hard, direct approach that he seems to be leaning towards right now, that he will have more success than he did last time in having his policies carried through?
Well, first of all, I'll say every president faces,
sure,
that, Democrat and Republican. So here's my big concern, and we'll segue to Hegseth, yeah, Gabbard, and let you talk a little bit more here, is I see him appointing people to destroy. I don't see him appointing, right, people to build. And so the question is, can Trump appoint people to tear things down? Yes, but can they build something that's even better? As former Speaker Sam Rayburn once said, anybody can tear down a barn. It takes a carpenter to build one.
Yeah.
I don't see in Hegseth, Gabbard, and Patel the skills to be a carpenter,
sure,
to build something as we want it to be or better.
You know, the other side of this is in the last Trump administration, there were many offices that people did not remain in for very long.
Yeah.
So it could be that some of these people will butt their heads against these challenges you're describing and then have to be replaced. so maybe some of these problems will resolve themselves.
Yeah. Yes. That's part. But it's also the fact of, are the people going to say it's not my fault,
yeah,
it's the deep state, in which case they're playing on,
sure,
Trump's insecurities.
It is an easy out.
Yes.
Right.
Right. I mean, and that's kind of the thing. I mean, and even when we're looking at Department of Defense, I mean, the idea we have to spend more, but what Trump is also saying is we're not spending the money well.
Sure.
And so he's expecting Hegseth to fix the procurement system.
Well, can we talk about him
system.
Then?
Yeah.
So, well, Hegseth is a, you know, he's for Secretary of Defense is what he's been chosen for. But I was surprised to see his nomination because I had never heard of him. And, you know, maybe that says more about me than it does about Hegseth.
No, that says something about Trump. So Hegseth is one of 15 Fox News, business news, all Fox News personalities who have had appointments.
Yeah.
So this is why Yuval Levin has said is we're moving more toward performance.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you saw is all these stories about Hegseth, who was a weekend co-host of Fox and Friends, was always saying things and then in commercial breaks checking his phone to see if he was getting a tweet from Trump because he thought he was trying to impress Trump.
Mm-hmm. So well, apparently it worked.
Yeah, it worked.
Right.
So the idea are there people who try to use their position to get on Trump's good side to advance themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, do they have the skills necessary? I mean, with Hegseth, he worked in two veterans type organizations, mm-hmm. which is great, but there are a lot of whistleblower stories to say he was let go because he was poor at managing that. And you've got the largest government enterprise is the Department of Defense,
mm-hmm.
and you got someone who's not good at managing that and who doesn't know much about defense policy at all. He's talked more about cleaning out the woke generals and admirals, in which case my response is, okay, yeah, I've got my problems with woke, but when I'm looking at the Department of Defense, I want good fighting men and women up and down the line. And I don't care if they're woke, if they can defeat the other side.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go through and purge generals for being woke without looking at what their other skills and qualifications, and if they're the best person for that position, that's where I think we have a problem.
Well, because that is the one thing we do know about Hegseth, and that's this thing he's written books about.
Yes.
Like that, right? So, I mean, it in terms of what would the foreign policy priorities be, what foreign policy priorities would be affected by him, it seems to just be a null point, right? It's moot. He doesn't seem to favor one or another because he's mostly internally focused, like some of the other choices.
Right. I mean, and on things which we'd say, is this really what we want the Secretary of Defense focusing on?
Right. You know, he's been one of the more complicated nominees. You know, there was quite a bit of scrutiny of some of his tattoos, for example, things like that. You know,
silly
story is emerging from his past. I did see that he said that if he gets the nominee or if he gets through, if he's confirmed, that he will no longer drink alcohol. So, you know, that's kind of fun.
Yeah, so, well, you have this accused sexual scandals, drinking problems, and problems managing an organization. Any other candidate would have been out by this point. And so this kind of shows on some level how much Trump values loyalty to where that's more important than competence, in which case my response is, why would you go that direction when you can find someone who's loyal and competent?
I mean, does such a person exist who's loyal and competent is the question.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there's plenty of people that you could throw out there. I mean, just think of the other names. Ron DeSantis, Joni Ernst, Tom Cotton.
Defense is a little harder find somebody for. But then again, I wouldn't have guessed Hegseth for the position either.
Yeah, well, nobody else did either.
Well, so we'll see what happens with that. Again, that's one of the more fraught ones, so I'm not as confident of that one happening. But, you know.
All right, well, let's talk about Tulsi Gabbard.
Yes.
The one who you are the most concerned with. Why?
Yeah, well, so when we talk about which conflicts we want to emphasize, you know, Gabbard is kind of an anti-image on some of these because it's not, you know, like with Waltz, he wants to emphasize China over Russia, but he still sees them both as strategic interests. When we Gabbard, especially in the last few years, has had a lot of talking points that seem to come from Russia-affiliated news agencies and propaganda sources.
Not seemed, did.
Well, right. Well, yeah. I mean, we have to make some inferences, right? But yeah, the you know, there's somewhere in where she gets her information seems to be from Russian propaganda. Now, I'm not saying that Tulsi Gabbard is an agent of the Russian government, but I do think that, you know, one might work for her, right? Like, that's the point where I'm cautious. And, you know, there are some positions where that's maybe not that bad. But Director of National Intelligence is, I mean, over the CIA, and, you know, we're looking at a position where, you know.
Well, yes.
On paper.
Yes,
yeah.
And no. I mean, some of the stuff I've read is, yeah, Gabbard's not a great pick, but this is the one position where she can't really do anything at all because she has no control over any of the other
agencies. It's not direct control, but they do report to her.
Report to her. Well, her big thing is creating the presidential daily
information
brief.
Information control.
Right, which goes to Trump.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, Trump has not been known to read his daily brief.
Yeah, but what if he did if a loyal person was giving it? Right?
Well,
I'm not here to try and attack Tulsi Gabbard's character, right? She seems to be someone who is civically minded in a lot of ways and really does care about these things. But when it comes to information, and this is an intelligence position, I find this to be much more concerning than some of the other things.
Yeah, right.
You know, like Hegseth might be distracted by internal political issues, but I don't think that he's rooting for the wrong side in any of the major conflicts the U.S. is involved in, right? And I'm just not certain of that with Gabbard, and that concerns me maybe more than some of the other picks.
Yeah, because you mentioned Russia. Gabbard was also supportive of the Assad regime.
That's right.
Yeah.
Thankfully, that won't be as much of a problem now.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And from what I have read, senators are telling the Trump people Gabbard's doing a horrible job.
Yeah.
Right now in their meetings with her, she doesn't have good answers for things.
Well,
and things that she should know should be coming her way, and she's probably the nominee that is most at risk at failing for the simple fact of
it's just not the
struggling.
Right position for her.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Again, I don't think it would be a disaster to have her in the Trump administration somewhere, but I think this might be the worst, one of the worst areas for her to be working in would be something with national security or intelligence, things like that. You know, it's funny that you mentioned support of Assad is a different issue than Russia, but if you look at where most of the articles and information out there that would make you support Assad, most of it comes from Russia. I mean, the Russia information networks are really good at putting out that kind of information. And that's the type of stuff that she's clearly reading. And again, you know, for a normal American citizen, that's fine. That's your information diet is something that you build based on your values, whatever. But when we're talking about someone who's going to be this close to the decisions that are made, it becomes a much bigger concern.
Right. And it shows the concern about does she listen to a wide variety of issues? Can she weigh evidence and ideas that she finds, or does she find things that confirms what she wants to believe already?
Well, and you know, I've spent the last week grading papers, right? And so I've been thinking a lot about the sources of information that you cite and bring in.
Yeah.
So maybe
yeah.
I'm just a little more touchy on this subject right now, but it's something that concerns me quite a bit there.
Okay. Do you have any other thoughts on any of the
other Trump? There's one other I wanted to mention.
All right.
Sometimes you pick someone as a signal. Right. I think that it's very telling that Mike Huckabee has been chosen as the ambassador to Israel.
Okay.
That is a very clear signal of what U.S. policy toward Israel is going to be. And interestingly, I think it's a signal that Israel is going to be left alone. It's a signal that Israel will not be criticized by the United States. It can do whatever it wants to do to solve its problems, because Huckabee is not just a Israel supporter. Huckabee he's also, you know, he will not use terms like West Bank when talking about that region, right? He completely supports all Israeli territorial claims, things like that.
And he does this from a theological
perspective. That's right. And that's something that I think is a signal to Israel that the United States is not going to be in its way in any of these conflicts. They're giving a complete supporter as the ambassador.
Yeah, and the other thing in this is there have also been some members of the far right in the Israeli government is saying, hey, here's our opportunity to actually annex the West Bank.
That's right. And again, I think that is a mistake also on their part, thinking that there's much policy significance to Huckabee being the choice. But I do think saying that they can, that they will be under less scrutiny is accurate. And at least that is what is meant to be communicated by picking him.
Okay. Our time is just about up. Any closing comments about what these picks mean,
you know,
for the U.S. and our foreign policy the next 4 years?
It is easy to be a critic, right? It's tough to fill these positions. The Trump administration did not do a very good job of filling them last time, and they have tried to hit the ground running. They're throwing out these picks much earlier. They're getting long lists sooner, and there's going to be some errors. I am hopeful that the ones that are throwing up alarm bells, or the ones that don't seem like good fits, or, you know, maybe misaligned on some things, I'm hopeful that that is a consequence of speed, not error.
Yeah.
And maybe in the time before the inauguration, these things will be cleared up.
Well, it would be nice if the Senate would play a more active role mm-hmm. in the advise and consent
That's right.
process.
That's right.
But the Trump people are doing everything they can to say, if you vote against our people, we're going to try to primary
you. And the Senate's going to have limited resources to oppose, right? You only have so many MAGA points, and you have to spend them wisely.
Right, yeah.
And
yeah.
If I were sitting in the Senate, I would say, let's spend them, let's be more interested in keeping Tulsi Gabbard away than maybe Hegseth. You know, but that's these are strategic decisions that they're all going to have to make. So, you know, we'll see.
All right. Well, thank you for talking to us about Trump's foreign
interesting conversation
policy. Yeah, and I'm sure we will continue these over the next 4 years. And yeah. With that, I'm going to yield back the balance of my time.